From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. It used to be that any novel which had a strong theme relating to the technology of the future was written off as science fiction. And yet it's impossible to write about our society and not include the incredible impact of technology. Today I speak with Alex Bescher. He is well known for his observations on business trends in the Pacific Rim, as well as his work as a contributing editor for InfoWorld magazine. We'll talk about his latest book, Rim, a novel of virtual reality. I'll also speak with Jonathan Nelson, president of Organic Online. For many years, the internet was the bastion of universities and government agencies. The latest change in the face of the internet is that commercial companies are now flocking to set up information services of their own. I'll be talking to Jonathan Nelson about just how to do that. Alex Bescher is my guest today. His new book, Rim, a novel of virtual reality, is being developed by TriStar for Robin Williams. Rim is filled with human passions, action, culture, metaphysical principles, and very importantly, technology. Since it takes place in the future, I asked him if he would consider it science fiction.
People have been scrambling to come up with different terms to describe it. It's been called cyber noir. I kind of like that.
That's good.
It's sold as science fiction, but I've seen it in bookstores in the nonfiction sections. I personally kind of conceive of it as sort of a consciousness thriller, you know, sort of picking up from the world of John Le Carré, where the spy came in from the cold, while the next activity, the next area of great activity, I think, for the world is going to be in the field of cyberspace or consciousness, actually. Cyberspace is just a medium or a vehicle for consciousness penetrating everywhere. And it raises all the old questions that have been around forever. But it's got parts detective story, adventure, thriller,
romance.
Love story, yeah, romance. It's an Asian story, Western story. It's a Pacific Rim story. It's a rim.
It says right on the cover, a novel of virtual reality. Tell us about that. Tell us about the whole premise for the book. You can't really dissect it into different compartments.
Well, the subtitle, that's the ingenuity of the publisher, I must say, to give it that subtitle. I hadn't thought of it. It had just been one word title for me, Rim. But the story takes place in the first part of the next century, post Cold War and post information age, when we're rapidly approaching new forms of media. West and East, Western science and Eastern philosophical traditions have sort of merged, where mysticism has become more scientific and science has become definitely more mystical. The newest areas of frontiers are consciousness. So we've moved from the world of, there's always a marketplace, of course, and that's part of the story here. We've moved from the world of word processing to consciousness processing. And what happens, basically the world is pretty much carved up by huge Japanese mega corporations called keiretsus, with their various strategic alliances. And the big ones are fighting it out, slugging it out for global domination. One of the largest ones is operating the world's first virtual reality metropolis, which is called Virtualopolis or Virtuopolis. And it caters to millions of people, entertainment, education, people. It's a very high level of virtual reality. And there's game time for kids with lots of different levels, adult world, business, downtown area where all kinds of business transactions are done, karaoke country, all this kind of somewhat hokey stuff. And what happens is there's a usual corporate intrigue and some sabotage, and Virtuopolis crashes with thousands of people online. And the hero of the story, Frank Gobi, is at that time, he's a professor of transcultural urban anthropology and organizational shamanism at the University of California in Berkeley, the Tokyo University Extension. In his former career, he was he had a budding career as a so-called consciousness detective, using intuitive analysis and highly refined forms to solve crimes and so on. But he's moved over to the academic field, and he's been hired as a consultant to raise this Virtuopolis that has crashed, because there are only like 3 days left to get people back online. People are all on brain support systems and neural supports to get them back online before the final omega disconnect point. And at first he's reluctant to do that, but then he discovers that his 10-year-old son, who is an avid V-boarder, virtual skateboarder, has been caught in game time, so he has to go in there and get them all up and running. And one of the key people is the CEO of this company, who's disappeared with the algorithm to launch this thing again. And so there's a lot of intrigue going on. That's basically the virtual environment, the thriller aspect of it.
There were many things that I liked about this. One of the things that fascinated me throughout is the presence of metaphysics and metaphysical principles that you often don't find on here. And some of it was Eastern, some of it was Western. What were you going for there?
I was really guided by the East-West shall meet, previously never the twain shall meet paradigm. Having been raised in Asia for most of my life, I guess I absorbed that kind of naturally, and having moved to California right at the time when the information revolution was taking over and the first PCs were coming out and being involved in that world, and as a journalist following the Pacific Rim technology trends and so on. So I happened to be right there in that place at that time. But of course, technology is more than just what makes things work and far out things and gadgets and gadgets and gizmos. It's really part of a greater process that's happening in the world. And I sort of saw that definitely as an evolutionary process that the world is going through. And using the Pacific Rim as a model, and this book is called Rim, I could see that the original movement in the Pacific Rim was perhaps dating back to the Silk Road 2,500 years ago, when trade was bringing people together and commodities were being carried by caravan from India through Central Asia to China and being dispersed throughout the region. Well, today we've got the Silicon Road, and our caravans are all online, and of course it's all driven by money and trade, but you've got these seeds of philosophical ideas and concepts that are just naturally slipped into that traffic as extra baggage, I suppose. And basically, the metaphysics and the technology are so intertwined. If you hear some of these people talking, like on the Electronic Frontier Foundation, John Barlow, Mitch Kapoor, they're talking in technological terms. Well, they're basically coming out of the closet and being real mystical about it. But what we're really seeing here is the world is slipping essentially from one dimension of being into another, and that's a metaphysical transition.
It's true. We often have been talking lately about, well, if you're on a line with somebody, is that relationship real? I mean, we already know telephones are real. You have a relationship talking there. And as more and more things are becoming real, it moves closer and closer to what has classically been sort of mystical and metaphysical. And I really see that coming together.
It's an interesting process, because as those things become more unreal, of course, you can easily perceive the unreality of them at the same time, because you say that your relationships in cyberspace with other people. Are they real or not? Yet you're getting together. All that stuff, to my mind, is basically just a mirror of what's happening outside. That's where the real consciousness game is being played in this material dimension, because what is exactly real about the relationship between people who are talking and facing each other? Lots of subtle little levels. So on one hand, when you're in a cyberspace mode, you may not have a whole array of inhibiting factors. But on the flip side of that, you've got a lot of illusion that you can pile up and create scenarios. It's no different than what we're doing in this world. And in RIM, the story, it's basically kind of a Buddhist slash Greek myth of this virtual city that crashes, trapping all these people. There's other stuff that happens too in the real world. Neo Tokyo or Japan has this mega earthquake, and a very bizarre thing occurs, and that is the city of Neo Tokyo just enters into another dimension at night. During the nighttime hours, everything closes up shop, you know, from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. It disappears off the face of the world. Nobody knows what's going on. It's sort of accelerating perhaps into another dimension. So my hero has to go through two regions of the dead and the damned, basically, to get to the prize, the Holy Grail. He's got to travel to Japan, which is under a world quarantine, slip into Neo Tokyo, and at the witching hour, some strange things start to happen. And the question is what? And he has to go through that experience and then find the keyhole into that down city. So he's got to go twice through Hades, really.
When you paint the picture of what the future is like in your novel, the idea of geopolitical boundaries as we know them today, they're not there. You don't have any problem with redefining how the world really looks. And part of that may be from your background. Tell us about your background. I was fascinated to learn earlier that you were a stateless person for years and years and years.
For the larger part of my life, it's true. I was technically stateless. Of course, there are different degrees of being stateless. As you can see, people in Africa are stateless too, millions and millions of people. I was never in a camp or anything, but I happened to be born of white Russian parents in China after the communists took over. And the Russians in China, anyway, there was a community there, had a lot of them had escaped from Russia after the Russian Revolution. There were two exoduses, one through Europe and one through China. And my family had gone the China route, and I'd been born there. And of course, what happened to China with the communists taking over, we had to leave in a hurry, and we had our adventures and pirates in the river and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And leaving by way of Australia and coming to Japan, where I grew up and lived. So I was still technically a stateless person until I was about 26 years old. I became an American citizen during the bicentennial year on April Fool's Day. So that to me was a little reminder that whatever state you think you're in, there's always a little undercurrent or subtext commentary. But I can readily identify with people who are stateless as a state of mind. In other words, they can go through walls and countries and barriers. All these things that we see as barriers really, to my mind, are really, really artificial. They definitely are artificial constructs, and they serve some sort of a purpose, but I think their time is rapidly approaching its demise, and the world is certainly moving we've gone from a geopolitical age to a geoeconomic age, and now it seems that we're moving more towards even a geo-spiritual age, in the sense that we're creating a new identity of what it means to belong. And there definitely is a state of belonging which has its stateless attributes, precisely because you don't belong to one particular thing. But I tend to feel that I belong to the whole rather than to any one little part.
As a stateless person, how do you travel between countries?
Very simply, you don't.
You stay where you are.
Exactly. I came over to the U.S. traveling on a Red Cross passport. And the only reason why I could come to the U.S. was because my mother had been born in Russia. She had left Russia when she was 1 year old. And so there was a quota at the time for Russians from Russia. It could have been a small quota, but nobody was filling it during the communist era. My father, on the other hand, had been born stateless in China, in a Russian community. So if it hadn't been for my mother's fortuitous, you know, having been born...
1 year.
Yeah, 1 year made the difference. So, you know, I could get my papers and apply and so on, and the Red Cross was only too happy to give me the document, and here I came.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Alex Bescher. He's well known for his observations on business trends in the Pacific Rim, as well as a contributing editor for InfoWorld. His latest novel is Rim, a novel of virtual reality. You're doing more than a book here. Tell us about all the other aspects of Rim.
There are tons of aspects of RIM. It went through so many different versions, actually about three different versions. I had originally conceived of it as a newspaper serial, but newspapers were hurting at the time. Nobody could see this thing. I'm glad that didn't work out that way because I was able to finally get down to it and approach it. In fact, the original appearance of RIM was in a Japanese technology magazine called Mac Power, published by Kei Nishi, who's formerly Bill Gates' partner. Macintosh magazine, one of the leading Mac magazines in Japan, because the Japanese could readily relate to the technology and culture changes in RIM, the futurism. The Japanese have 1 foot in the 21st century already anyway, and they've been there for about 10 years. And finally, I got an American publisher, HarperCollins West. It had to be a West Coast-based publisher because they could definitely see it. Anybody in the East Coast are saying, what is that? It wasn't an easy sell. I mean, now I've got movie producers and game producers. Everybody's lining up. But it was not an easy sell. This story has got elements of technology, Asian philosophical traditions, you know, throw in a little techno-gnosticism, a whole different worldview embedded in it, tons of techno gizmos that I just sort of stream of consciousness channeled this stuff, but some of it is very real. There's so much going on in it, and it's an adventure story. So I think that's what keeps it all in focus.
And yet, Frank Gobi, the central character, the hero, if you will, is very American. I identified with him very much.
Well, he's really balanced between East and West. His name actually Gobi. That's the Central Asian desert, and it's kind of a metaphor for being a go between. Gobi is between East and West. He's lived here. He's developed a family here. He's got one son. He's teaching here. He's comfortable with the way the vision of the technology, but he's also very rooted in the metaphysical aspects of the Asian traditions. So he's got 1 foot in each worldview, and it's sort of a kind of a unique blending there. But I think that in the future, we're seeing it already happening. The Asians are coming to the West Coast to rediscover some of their own traditions. You know, they all have to come to Esalen to get the designer brand of latest Taoism or, you know, a little quantum physics mixed in with the Tao, mm-hmm. To take it back, and it validates their own original traditions. And we're going over there, and with travel and communications and the net, it's all becoming quite an exciting goulash, really, or a sukiyaki.
It's all mixed together.
Yes.
All mixed together. Tell us about the games. People are looking for interactive games. What's coming out there?
Well, we've just interactive games these days are come appended to movies. So we've just closed the deal with a major Hollywood studio for a major star. I can't identify that right at the moment because we're just signing and it doesn't do, knock on wood and so on. But part of the package, of course, is the interactive rights because games are making more money than
From the movies?
Movies these days.
So when you negotiate the movie, you got to negotiate the game.
You definitely do. And in the old days, the artist or the creative person would basically just hand over everything to the studio, you know, take the money for the movie and disappear, become a wallflower or a consultant to the screenplay. But now it's a new ball game, and I think artists and writers, and I encourage them who are kind of straddling these two mediums, should definitely stand up for their rights. And it is a question of rights, because that's part of the package. You've got to have part of everything and not just be contented with the movie side of it. Parenthetically, I can identify it since this is going to air a few weeks from now, that it was TriStar Pictures acquiring RIM for Robin Williams's Blue Wolf Productions, which is a very exciting development for me. And he's really, really big on technology and computer games. And it seems like an ideal kind of an adventure, because there's a lot of slapstick and humor and adventure in it.
Physical movement, you know.
Yes. He'd make an interesting Frank Gobi, but of course I think there would be monologues that Frank Gobi could never envision in his own head on the page. That's another
and
added
you would want
dimension.
That, I guess.
Yes. But the story of RIM is a game within a game type of thing. So actually the scenario, a certain section of the book where Gobi's son is trapped in game time, he's been V-boarding in this skateboard game level, and there's been the whole city, Virtuopolis, crashes, and he finds himself falling through, and he ends up in Trekland, in virtual Sikkim, or in the Himalayas, the virtual Himalayas. And there are all kinds of Tibetan gdons and ogres and ghouls that are making their debut, I think, in Western literature at this time, including the most terrifying Tibetan creature since the abominable snowman, which is like your dear, you know, favorite uncle compared to the Rimi that makes its debut in my book RIM. Little funny things like earth shoe characters running around, you know, that some trekkers had left, and they've been breeding in game time ever since, and just a lot of challenges. And it's basically that game within a game is based on the Tibetan wheel of life and going through all the different realms of the gods and the demigods. And so it's a new kind of a thing. But then the other aspects of it, the science fiction virtual reality, or the Wi-Fi rather than sci-fi aspects of it, lend themselves quite readily, apparently, to the game world. So different platforms. We're looking at down the road a bit. Of course, things are going to be evolving and have been evolving from your old standard Nintendo or even Super Nintendo games to CD-ROM to what we're looking at, online interactive virtual reality environments. That's where it's all heading, really.
Did you have any idea this was all going to happen when you were writing this book?
I had no idea. I had no idea. I was just your average starving artist.
I'm just making all this up and putting it in my book. And suddenly you're dealing with movie studios and games and merchandising. And
yeah, I still don't like to think about that aspect. In fact, I don't deal with it. Personally, you know, I have my family members, my dear wife, Francoise, who's been conscripted to deal with agents and studios and things like that, because I'm just a writer. I can't function in that realm.
My guest today is Alexander Bescher. Alex has a diverse background, including being editor-in-chief of the Chicago Review and a consulting futurist for Global Business Network. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I do want to take not such a projection way into the future as your new novel, but more the future of technology and in the Pacific Rim specifically. I don't really understand what's happening now in the whole Pacific Rim and where we're going in the next, say, 10 years. Can you give us some insight into that?
Well, the bits and the bytes and the gigabytes and all that kind of stuff and the schematics, I can't really address that because I'm not really a technical person, but I can see the direction that it's headed. Even 10 years ago, I remember I was in a hotel suite interviewing the president of the Japanese company NEC. And he was talking about his vision. One day he'd pick up a telephone and speak in Japanese on one end and it would come out in English on the other, or in whatever language. I mean, that's one thing that's definitely happening. Cyberspace is definitely going to become globalized and internationalized, and the whole new medium for business and communications. The World Wide Web is going to attract a lot of stuff. The Japanese are jumping into that. They're still trying to figure out what it is, too. In terms of products, the stuff that I describe in my book is really almost an extrapolation of what's happening today. We've got consciousness processors. We've got digitizing matter. We've got downloading consciousness, all that kind of stuff. Well, that's being touted in sort of the fringe science sector today, but we're moving towards it. You can read articles in the New York Times or what have you, mainstream media, talking about new developments of neurotechnology, neuroelectronics, where people can manipulate word processing applications just by through their brain waves. That's a whole new area. It's very cumbersome and clumsy, and originally intended for people like who are quadriplegics and so on. But we're moving in that way. There's a whole new area that is just waiting to happen. So we're still in the very mechanical side of things, I feel. But in the future, it's the book is so full of this stuff, I can't even begin to address it.
I almost don't even want to start talking about it because it's the idea of you're looking at this thing and you're saying, oh, it's a beautiful flower, and you're describing it. And is it real? Is it not real? Is it a hologram? Is it?
Exactly. In fact, the book starts with a tea ceremony in Neo-Tokyo in the year 2025, and it's very much a VR thing. It's a virtual reality ceremony. And where the master of tea, dressed in his traditional kimono, and he's got this top Japanese corporate mogul sitting there, and what he's doling out is really these pixels from some other dimension instead of this green tea, and he's wearing the glove on his hand as he's stirring the tea and so on. There's a lot of whimsical, amusing stuff, but I think it touches a nerve, and there's a seed of truth to it. For example, I've got people, American corporate salarymen who have adopted Japanese business mannerisms or bowing, How do you do, Smith-san? Have a nice trip, Johnson-san. They're wearing, their corporate suits are like interface threads, they're known as. Most of these suits are probably leased from AT&T because they're all interactive and they've got communications devices sewn in and just a whole maze of stuff. The future definitely holds more and more of that stuff that we can't even conceive of in a most mind-boggling way even today. And so what I'm doing is I'm just tweaking the imagination. I think that some of the stuff that I describe is really going to probably come out and be available one day.
Alex, you will come back and talk to us again, won't you?
If not in this life, then in the next.
Perfect. Thank you. My guest today has been Alex Bescher. His new book is RIM, a novel of virtual reality, published by HarperCollins West. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Jonathan Nelson is the president of Organic Online. This new company addresses a recent trend in commercial businesses. I asked him to tell me about it.
Presently, people are building what they call sites on the internet. And what our company, Organic Online, does is actually does the actual implementation of a site online. For instance, we work with Volvo Motor Cars, and we built a site for them which has approximately 200 pages of information about those automobiles, so that it becomes sort of a research tool, so that if you're interested in Volvo Auto Cars, you can get on the internet and go into their site and find anything you'd ever want to know about Volvos. Say you want to know about the safety features. There's detailed descriptions of airbags and how they work and how Volvo does it differently, or engine specifications, or pictures of the automobiles and the interiors, and lists of dealers all over the United States, so that you could click on a map of the U.S. and go and find the dealer closest to you. All of these databases presently right now are free, so it's really just a giant informational resource right now.
So this is a brand new thing where people say, golly, you know, you don't have to go into a dealer, you don't have to call us up, we don't have to mail you something. People with personal computers of some variety want to be able to go through the data that they want, and as well as see pictures. What do you need to get on a system like that? We'll just use Volvo as an example.
Okay. You can use almost any type of home computer. The internet doesn't really care whether you're on an Apple Macintosh or whether you're on an IBM PC or even a Unix workstation. So you need the computer first of all. Then you will need a modem. Any speed will do. And then you need a place to dial to what is called an internet service provider. So when you dial your modem, you can connect to somebody who in turn is connected to the internet. So you use them as your sort of gateway or conduit to the internet. And once you're on the net, you can just cruise around and look at Volvo Motor Cars, Wired Magazine, archives of Frank Zappa's music, really just anything. It's unbelievable how much information is out there. And presently, almost all of it is free.
Well, we recently spoke with the Computer Life people, that new magazine, and they knew right from the start, we not only have to have a magazine, but we have to have a bulletin board, online information service.
Sure.
I mean, these are, you know, Volvo, Club Med among your clients. These are established companies.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening? So, it seems like in the last year, people are realizing they've got to have online databases.
Well, the internet provides an interesting opportunity to put the information up there so that it's voluntarily accessed by the user. So if you're interested in a Club Med vacation and you're aware that Club Med exists online, you don't need to send away for the catalog. You can just dial up clubmed.com, which is their internet address, and look at pictures of the resorts, read the menus for the restaurants, find the prices of the actual vacation, look at little video clips, really whatever you want, and find all that information at your fingertips on your desktop when you have the time to do it. So it just becomes this giant resource.
So if I'm a company, and whether I'm a brand new company or I've been around for a while, and I want to get my stuff on the net, I either can get very expert in things or I can come to a company like Organic Online. What exactly do you do for companies?
Well, we do a number of things. We do a lot of consulting and just hand-holding and getting people accustomed to this new type of delivery mechanism and sort of educating people about the possibilities of the medium. Once people are educated to the point where they can make a decision, we will actually go about designing a site. There's a lot of interface design issues so that all the information is laid out correctly, concisely, and clearly, so that the user doesn't need to spend hours searching around within a site to find that little shard of information they've been looking for all along. Then once the overall site is mapped out, we actually can digitize the information and start filling in the skeleton so that the site takes shape. Once the site is in shape, we put it onto our computers, which are high-speed data servers that sit directly on the internet, and make the information available to the rest of the world. Then we also have what we call net surfers, who are sort of our online publicists. And the net surfers go out and say, okay, Club Med or Canary Press, who is another one of our clients, is now online. Go to canary.com and you'll find all the information you want about this small press, so that people know that it's there.
So you go out and lay a few seeds around. So
exactly.
People are going around saying, oh, I can find out about Volvo.
Exactly. So that we will search out indexes. On the internet, everybody is talking about indexes. So we find the appropriate indexes. Club Med is travel. Canary Press is books. Volvo might be automobiles or, commercial sites on the internet. On and on. We try to place it in as many places as possible so that people can find their way to the site and get the information that they want.
If I'm a company, I can talk to somebody like Organic Online to say, well, here's all my information, all my marketing materials and all of that. What do you think we should put out there? What can we put out there? You help them organize that. You help them get it in there. Certainly with pictures, those have to be digitized and entered and put in the structure. You actually provide the computer site and I guess their address?
Exactly.
On the net. So they don't even have to buy computers or any of that.
Sure.
And then you have people going out sort of seeding the internet saying, hey, come look over here.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're making it real easy for a company to suddenly be online.
Turnkey solution to any company's internet needs.
That's great. My guest today is Jonathan Nelson. He's the president of Organic Online. They help commercial companies fully utilize the internet. Now, I wouldn't like to say is that we've been talking commercial companies, but you do help some not-for-profits as well. What's their interest in getting information out?
Well, it's the same. It's the name of the game here is information and getting information to the people that want it, whether it be through a magazine, through a newspaper, or an advertisement on television. The idea is that you're conveying information to people, and the internet's just a new medium to do that. Nonprofits need to disseminate their information just the same as a Volvo or a Club Med need to disseminate their information. So one of the nonprofits we're working with right now is called the company is called CAF, Community Alliance for Family Farmers, and they have a newsletter called Farmer to Farmer, which is based here in California, in right near Sacramento. And what they're doing is teaching family farmers how to grow organically. And whenever they publish their newsletter, they give us all of the graphics and text, and we digitize it and we put it up online for free so that people can find it. And it's amazing who responds to these things. We've gotten letters back from Germany, from Russia, from Asia, of people reading about this group of nonprofit farmers in the Sacramento Valley, just interested in what they're talking about and just sort of lending their support or asking a question or soliciting more information.
Well, I guess that's part of what's interesting about this to me is saying, well, you got a newsletter, you got a mailing list, you slap the stamp on, you get it out of here, that's who it goes to. Fully, a third, a half, they've always gotten the newsletter, so they throw it away.
Exactly.
Sits in a pile for a while, and then they throw it away. And if you can't send it to some people who might be interested, well, you never hit them at all. So if you're not interested, you never look up the newsletter, even though you may be on the primary mailing list. If there are people who are interested, who can then gain access. And there's a very one-to-one matching of the people who are interested to the information that you don't get with normal mailings.
Exactly. Keep in mind that the internet, you voluntarily go to access the information that you want to find. So if you don't want to look at Volvo or Club Med or any of those types of commercial sites, don't go there. You don't need to see it.
But no farming, no info.
Yeah, exactly. But if you are interested in organic farming, go and look at Farmer to Farmer online. It's a huge archive of just information about that subject. And likewise, the internet is just filled with thousands of different subjects and huge archives of information on them.
Now we're just talking about providing information. What if I have a question? Do I just call them up or can I ask my question online?
Well, we'll oftentimes put up the phone number, the 800 number of the company that we're working with. But we also build mechanisms so that you could fill in your email address and also type in a short question and shoot it off to whoever the person is. One of the new components of the Volvo site, will be a thing called Ask Dr. Volvo. So you can get on there and say, you know, I'm Joe at organic.com, and I've got a problem with my transmission. It rattles, and I'm not sure what to do. And you can send that off to Dr. Volvo, and Dr. Volvo in a few days will respond to you, and he'll say, well, here's a list of dealers, you know, certified by Volvo to do the mechanic work on your car. You know, go call one of these people.
In any cases, can you place orders over the internet?
You will be able to do that in the future. That, however, there are a few stumbling blocks for that. The main one is what we call in the industry encryption. And what that is the ability to scramble a credit card number, for instance, and in order to keep it safe from prying eyes, and then send it along with your order for, say, a CD. That's really the only way that you can do it, and it would be safe for both the person sending the credit card and the person that will be sending you the CD. And that technology is about 6 months to a year away.
So right now we can't place orders for a new Volvo or a Pirate or something.
You could place orders. The same mechanism that we use to ask a question of Dr. Volvo could be used to order a Volvo, but the question then is, how do you pay for it? I guess you could sort of like say, I want to buy this car and I'll pay for it later. But really what will be happening in the future is you'll be able to go through, say, a music database, and you'll be able to listen to samples of the record, and then if you like it, you'll be able to hit the button that says order, and then you'll type in your credit card number, send it along, and pretty soon you'll have that CD sitting on your doorstep, and you'll be able to listen to it at home in its entirety.
One thing I'm not clear on is why sending your credit card number over the internet might be unsafe if you're sending it to a particular place to order in.
Oh, without getting into real technical explanations of how the internet works, the information passes through what are called hubs, and the information can be looked at by a number of people along the way. And if you're looking at information about Volvo automobiles or hearing sound snippets, most people wouldn't care too much to snoop on you. But if you're shipping a lot of financial information or credit card numbers, for instance, that'd
be real interesting.
It would be real interesting to certain people. So just by nature of the internet being distributed all over the world, there are a number of people that have access to the information as it's being shipped. Now, unless that information is scrambled, you know, someone could grab a credit card number or look at your bank statement or anything like that.
Another thing that's fascinating about the internet is it's almost like telephones in some way, is that if I'm logging on here and I'm going to be talking to you here, we don't know how circuitous the path is from me to you. We don't know how many computers it may go through.
Yeah, exactly.
And it may switch from, I did this morning and I'm doing it this afternoon, and it's a different path that makes
exactly.
it through. So you really... You could try to do it again to see if somebody watches, and you might not find that same person. So I can, it's pretty mysterious.
Yeah, well, you can sort of see where things go, but you're not sure that somebody looked at it along the way.
Now, are there any new technologies coming along besides encryption that will change what these companies will be able to do online?
Well, most of the components are actually there right now. On the internet, presently, there's the ability to do video, audio, text and graphics, just pictures, as well as build what we call forms mechanisms or interfaces to do ordering or ask Dr. Volvo about your transmission or whatever. The new things besides encryption will actually be the ability for mortal humans to connect to the internet, i.e. very easy interfaces to actually dial your modem and get onto the net, as well as larger amounts of bandwidth strung into the home, so that you'll be able to listen to those records or view the videos in a much more timely fashion. So those are the real big next steps.
What bandwidth means is simply that the amount of stuff you can get into your line, so wider path you can get into your home, will be much bigger. So instead of having to wait 10 minutes to download 15 seconds of data, 15 seconds of music.
Yeah.
You can get it in 15 seconds or
yeah,
less.
Yeah, exactly, or less. It bandwidth, I like to think of it in terms of like pipes. If you think of it right now, there's like a garden hose going into each house, whereas in the future, you'll have a large, big 6-inch pipe of data just streaming into your house, which you can turn on at any point and get video and audio and text and all the information that you want to find easily.
If we're talking about companies, we usually have to talk about advertising. And this is a very subtle form of advertising, that you want information, we'll give you information. Is there actually also advertising going on the net?
Well, in some ways, it's all advertising. In some ways, it's kind of a tricky game, actually. I mean, for a company like Volvo that has so many stories to tell about airbags and engine specifications, it could be looked at as the entire thing is an ad, and a lot of people choose to do it that way. For other people that are actually looking for that information, you know, they don't care whether it's an ad. It's a resource. I mean, a lot of times advertising becomes a semantic classification, if you will. Farmer to Farmer, the nonprofit, you know, people don't think of nonprofits as advertising per se, but in a sense, by putting their newsletter online, they're talking about themselves. So that's an ad as well. So, yeah, either all of it's an ad or none of it's an ad or somewhere in between.
I see. My guest today is Jonathan Nelson. He's president of Organic Online, a new firm here in San Francisco, which has been helping companies bring their information to the Internet. Now, Jonathan, are there some ethical concerns about what you put on the Internet? I mean, what are we talking about?
Absolutely. We try to really find what the story is behind each company. And if there's not much of a story behind a company, like what can you say about Coca-Cola, for instance? I mean, not that Coke is one of our clients or anything, but it's a soft drink. Everybody knows what Coca-Cola is. And beyond talking about the silky smooth taste and the effervescing bubbles, what can you really say about Coke? So you try to build something, a place where people would want to go, whether that be a water cooler type place or a Coke machine online where people would want to go and chat and, you know, meet people from all different countries, or present sort of a resource. One of our clients is 1-800-COLLECT. And what we're doing for them is building a system whereby if you hear a lot of, on the internet, everybody talks in terms and acronyms and all these kind of computer geek language. And if you hear a term like FAQ, F-A-Q, which means frequently asked question, you could type in FAQ and it will spit back the answer for you. So we're really building a resource for 1-800-COLLECT so that people will want to go back there. And it becomes an associative type of marketing so that we're providing something that's actually of use to the user while also, you know, tacking on a product, and hopefully they'll use 1-800-COLLECT, and hopefully they'll come back and use our list of internet terms.
There's some part of me that's trying to connect what's happening here. This is the natural step, you know, companies getting their information out. I kind of go back to the early days of television, and for many, many years, television was free, and you watched the major networks and maybe a couple of local, one local station, something like that, and television was free. Now, over time, like there are cable fees that you pay, mm-hmm. or certain networks that you buy into, and you can only get some of them by paying a fee and some not. Do you see that kind of transition happening in these kind
sure.
of databases?
Absolutely. Well, not for our databases. You know, how many people are going to pay to look at a Volvo site? You know, it should be free. I mean, they're trying to get their information into the hands of the user. But if you were Time Magazine, for instance, you need financial incentive to put your information up there. Mm-hmm. And there will certainly be mechanisms that are built so that the Time Magazines of the world can get paid to digitize their information. And it's our firm belief that information really wants to be free, And yet, you know, there are economic realities of digitizing, and, you know, you have to pay a staff to get all this stuff up there and run it all on these computers. But it doesn't need to be that expensive. I mean, right now the government is paying $12 million a year to support the internet. And when you amortize the $12 million cost over the 25 million users of the internet, I mean, it comes out to about 50 cents a person. So
it's the only deal.
Yeah, it's the only deal. I mean, it doesn't need to be real expensive, but there will be some kind of mechanism which it becomes more commercialized and actually is you get charged money to look at certain things. But hopefully the Volvo, I mean, almost certainly the Volvos and Club Meds and City of Tribes records will stay free.
I think this brings me to another question that's been sort of bearing on me for a while, and that is that there's a huge industry in book publishing, and there's no doubt about it. And the good deal is you sell one book, you make that profit, and it's a one-to-one kind of a deal. And many people have said, well, gee, in libraries, we could just have the book on data, and different people can read it and use it. The whole economics of the book publishing industry just gets shot if you don't have that one-to-one mechanisms, because once you put data on a database, it's there. It can be copied many times. It can be looked at many different ways. I mean, are we going to see some industries actually fall apart because of this information?
I think you'll see some industries mutate. I mean, a lot of people are talking about the book industry because it's such an obvious corollary between text, which everybody's used to looking at in terms of books or magazines or newspapers, and also text on a computer screen. However, I think that very few people want to read a 400-page novel. They don't want to read War and Peace online.
Sitting up.
Yeah, sitting in front of a phosphorescent screen. You're going to get through about 25 pages and then go for the Advil. It doesn't make a lot of sense to read online. I mean, of course, the technology will come up with better ways that are easier on the eyes to read online, but at least right now, there's not a real replacement for a good paper book that you're holding in your hands and putting on your lap late at night. But yeah, I think some industries will mutate. One of the first industries I think will mutate will be the music industry, that in the next 5 to 10 years, you'll have an unlimited record collection. You'll just dial up and you'll say, I want to listen to this latest record by the Rolling Stones, and you'll pay a small amount of money to play it once, and if you like it, you'll play it again. And that will change that industry dramatically. So yeah, some industries really will change.
I've had that same reaction. People have said, gee, you're only an hour a week, and you should be every day, or you should be three times a week or twice a week. And I kind of look at them and say, well, gee, pretty soon you'll just be able to dial it up when you want it. And anyone who wants to listen to more than an hour of me should send me email. I want your name. Why would you want to do that? And from a radio standpoint, you've got to have that much airtime to get somebody to listen to you once a week.
Exactly.
To go every day.
I mean,
selective listening.
Exactly. You'll be able to find what you want. And in a certain way, that's really empowering. And if there's a little bit of an economic incentive for your radio station to put you online, they'll do it. And they'll put your archive up there, and everybody will listen to your show as they want it.
When you're talking to companies and you're trying to put together what their service are, or just talking to them about what's possible, what are the hardest things for them to comprehend about what you're doing?
That's a funny question, actually. It's interesting to see how companies who are so used to writing copy in terms of like a one-page ad in a magazine, you know, you put up a nice slick picture of your product and you write a juicy one-paragraph bit of copy about your product and that's it. You know, all of a sudden these companies have an unlimited resource. They can put up anything that they want about their product or about similar products or even do associative advertising, as in the case of 1-800-COLLECT. And it's a little bit hard to get through to a lot of people that all of a sudden Volvo has the opportunity to put up a giant database, and they can put up, and they have put up, government reports about safety, an unlimited number of pictures of their products, you know, tons and tons of text. I mean, there's probably 200 pages of text in the Volvo site right now. it's really unlimited what they can do. And I think that is a little intimidating at first, but then a lot of companies sort of take the ball and run with it. You know, there's a lot of stories to be told out there and a lot of people that are wanting to hear those stories. So it's really kind of liberating after a while once you kind of figure out the medium.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
My guest today is Jonathan Nelson, president of Organic Online, a San Francisco company devoted to helping commercial companies bring up databases on the internet. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called a stabilizing influence.
In addition to lighting most of our nights, the moon furnished a nearby target for mankind's first extraterrestrial landings and has provided poets and storytellers with sufficient material for several civilization worths of myths and legends. Now, computer simulations suggest that our gratitude towards Earth's only natural satellite might extend even further. We may owe our very existence to the moon. It's human nature to look at conditions today and assume that they've always been this way. It's hard to believe, for instance, that our present climate is a mere interglacial blip, an anomalous 10,000 years of warmth within the past 2 million-year deep freeze that we call the Pleistocene. Despite such ups and downs, Earth has an extraordinarily stable history overall. Ice ages have always been limited to higher latitudes, and the oceans have never totally frozen over or boiled away. Our planet has been temperate for the past 4 billion years. It now seems that we have the moon to thank for this stability. Compared to other planet-moon combinations, and with the exception of distant Pluto and its moon, our natural satellite is massive in relation to its parent body, planet Earth. And that's what has kept our planet tilted uniformly on its axis throughout our planet's long history. For over 4 billion years, the tilt has been pretty stable, approximately what it is today, about 23 degrees. No tilt, no seasons. Extreme tilt, extreme seasons. Had Earth's tilt fluctuated, causing extreme climatic conditions, it's unlikely that life could have consistently survived through the eons, from its initial toehold all the way down to the present day. But why would the Earth's tilt change anyway? Because, like all planets, Earth isn't perfectly round. It bulges at the equator. This means that the gravitational pull of other planets has a slight, but in the long term chaotic, effect on our tilt. Computer simulations show that without the moon, the rest of the solar system would have caused wild fluctuations on our tilt, and hence on the climate. Mars, for instance, with two tiny moons, appears to have suffered just that fate. Instead, we lucked out. Any incipient destabilizing effects from neighboring planets are offset by our comparatively massive moon. If Earth is the cradle of life, the moon prevents it from being rocked too much by its neighbors. So far, at least. The moon is slowly accelerating away from us, slowing Earth's spin slightly in the process. In my 84-year-old mother's lifetime, the moon has moved an average of 10 feet farther away from the Earth. And in another billion or so years, the moon will be too far away to stabilize us, and our climate will be subject to the chaotic whim of the planets, just like happened with Mars. But until that day, the moon is taking care of us.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.